Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. This week on the show...
Zelensky was told to not let himself get angry or frustrated by anything that Trump said, and they seem to have the kind of roles within the kind of meeting from the European side pretty much divided out, with Mark Rutte, the NATO Secretary General, giving the kind of précis, the conclusion remarks. Those arguments seemed to get Trump's attention.
High-stakes diplomacy on behalf of Ukraine. An unlikely rapprochement between two historic enemies and European alarm at Israel's actions in Gaza. That's all here on Inside Europe. It's been a week of feverish speculation in Europe. Depending on which commentaries you've been reading, Donald Trump's Alaska summit with President Vladimir Putin either represents the best chance for peace in Ukraine that there's been in a long while, or a hubristic venture doomed to end in US capitulation to Russian demands. Inside Europe is recorded on Thursday, so we have no way of knowing the outcome of that meeting. What we do know, however, is that on Wednesday, Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky flew to Berlin to take part in a pre-summit video call convened by Germany's Chancellor Friedrich Merz. The aim of the call was to ensure that President Trump would have the Ukrainian perspective, as well as the perspective of European leaders and NATO chief Mark Rutte, fully in mind as he prepared to meet Vladimir Putin. I spoke to DW's Kyiv correspondent Nicholas Connolly on Thursday morning, just after that conference call, but before the Alaska summit. It was, I put to him, a strange limbo sort of time.
Definitely. And the fact that you had Volodymyr Zelensky, Ukraine's president, going to Berlin to take part in a video call, you know, is in itself strange, right? This is an online meeting with Trump, but he wanted to at least have the Europeans on his side of the webcam, as it were, to try and make it clear to Trump that Ukraine's and Europe's red lines are relevant, and to remind him of those and to prevent him giving away lots of Ukrainian territory without asking the Ukrainians. But it's definitely the second choice option. When you talk to politicians here, they were all convinced that Zelensky was going to be in Alaska. Certainly, they'd been reporting that Trump had demanded Putin to meet Zelensky. And then, as seems so often to be the case, Trump basically, when Putin didn't budge, just forgot about it and decided to meet him after all, one-on-one.
So, given that it was Berlin and not Alaska for Volodymyr Zelensky, how much hope, how much confidence do Ukrainians have at the moment in German diplomacy and what that might be able to achieve?
I think more broadly, they are positively surprised at what this new German government has done in terms also of defense support and in terms of the tone as well. Obviously, the tone, the support for Ukraine is a bit more wholehearted, a bit more kind of vocal and demonstrative than was the case with the previous government under Olaf Scholz, where there was support for Ukraine, yes, but an unwillingness to kind of say that this commitment was there forever and that Ukraine should win this war, or that, you know, this was about Ukraine's sovereignty, was all a bit more careful and seemed often a bit flaky from a Ukrainian perspective. I think it does seem like the Europeans choreographed this meeting quite well from the reporting that's out there. You hear about the fact that everyone was on message, that everyone was brief to keep it short so that Trump wouldn't get distracted or zone out. Zelensky was told to not let himself get angry or frustrated by anything that Trump said. And they seem to have the kind of roles within the kind of meeting from the European side pretty much divided out, with Mark Rutte, the NATO Secretary General, giving the kind of précis, the conclusion remarks. Seemingly, according to the reporting people who listened to that call, those arguments seemed to get Trump's attention.
Well, indeed. I mean, Trump rated it 10 out of 10.
Well, I'm not sure how seriously we can take that. I mean, I think they are all now experienced enough with Trump to know that there has to be a lot of praise and a lot of sycophancy to get his attention. But certainly the test of that will be, you know, what he comes out with in Alaska. If you remember the last big Trump-Putin summit in Helsinki in 2018, he left that meeting saying that he believed Putin's word over what the US intelligence agencies had told him. So there is still a big worry here that for all the preparation and all the attempt to get the European and the Ukrainian position across, once he's in a room with Putin, that might all go out the window.
Right. And Russia, of course, has been very clear about what it wants out of that meeting with President Trump in Alaska. It set out maximalist demands, which would involve Ukraine handing over all of Russian occupied territory and committing to not joining NATO. So, Nick, worst case scenario, we have a repeat of Helsinki. Trump emerges from that room, having been dazzled once again by Vladimir Putin and accepting all those demands. To use a Trumpian concept here, what cards does Ukraine have?
I think it's important to really take stock and actually see that I think America has less leverage over Ukraine than was the case under Biden, because simply they have stopped giving aid, right? There's still some aid that was promised by Biden that's still trickling across the Ukrainian border, but largely anything new is now for cash. Ukraine is a client buying American weapons with its own money and with European money, but it is not as dependent on the American administration and its goodwill as was the case just a couple of months ago. So they've had some time to readjust. It's obviously not ideal. It's not the preferred scenario, but it is holding up for now. There are obviously still things that America does for Ukraine in terms of sharing intelligence, in terms of also supporting European countries through NATO, through other cooperation, which then allows those European countries to free up capacity and to hand over weapons to Ukraine. So theoretically, even if Trump says, I'm not interested anymore, you're the bad guys, you've been the impediment to a deal now, it doesn't mean that Ukraine has to roll over the next day and accept any kind of settlement that Trump wants to impose or would have to stop fighting because the Americans disengage. I don't think that's the case. Obviously, there are also questions about weapon sales. Would Ukraine still be at the top of the queue, as it were? Because lots of these weapon systems have, you know, years of waiting times if you're just kind of trying to get them new. But broadly, there is a bit of resilience there. There is some capacity there. But obviously, that break with Trump is not something that anyone here wants to see happen. And we've seen the Europeans basically take kind of control of those relations as best they can between Zelensky and the Trump White House after the bust up in the Oval Office early in the year. And as we understand, are coaching Zelensky and his team on how to communicate with the Trump White House and are trying to prevent the kind of emotional meltdown that we saw, you know, earlier in the year.
And meanwhile, of course, the fighting continues and facts on the ground are being established. What is the current situation on the battlefield right now, Nick?
Well, there's definitely a sense that Putin is throwing everything he has at the Ukrainian front lines to see what works and to also just try and grab as much territory as he can. Now, especially in these days leading up to the meeting in Alaska, there is a real sense that this isn't necessarily sustainable, that even though Russia does have significantly bigger resources than Ukraine, that's clear. But even for their standards, the losses are very high, and this isn't necessarily something they can carry on doing for months and months longer. They're trying to gain more ground and potentially force Ukraine into retreating from the city of Pokrovsk in Donetsk region. We've had reports of Russian reconnaissance groups, sometimes 5 to 10 kilometers behind Ukrainian lines, trying to kind of either surround them or, you know, basically create kind of panic behind the Ukrainian front lines. As far as we understand, the Ukrainians are, for the large part, able to push these groups back or to find them. These are not groups on with tanks or kind of heavy armored vehicles. They're often on foot or on motorbikes. So they are not holding all the territory that they are present in, but certainly it is a very scary situation for people in the east of Ukraine. But you know, having said that, we talked about Pokrovsk falling to Russia basically at the end of last year, and it still hasn't happened. So there is constant Russian pressure. They are moving forward, but it is not catastrophic for now. And we know that if you're trying to defend territory, you can, you know, do so with significantly fewer resources, fewer boots on the ground than if you're trying to take territory. Often the kind of analysts would say that it's 3 to 1. You need 3 times more forces to take land than you do to hold it. And there is just a real sense that this is now about Putin trying to impress Trump and to create the kind of headlines that would make a Russian victory in Ukraine seem inevitable and to justify forcing Ukraine into giving up territory that it still controls.
Nick Connolly in Kyiv, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
My pleasure.
DW's Kyiv correspondent, Nick Connolly there. Whilst, as we've just heard, Ukrainians are not setting their hopes too high on the outcome of President Trump's Alaska meeting with Vladimir Putin, it might be worth remembering that Trumpian diplomacy has yielded dramatic and unexpected results in recent weeks. Only this month, the leaders of Armenia and Azerbaijan signed a groundbreaking peace agreement brokered by US President Donald Trump at the White House. The deal offers the hope of ending decades of conflict, along with the opportunity of Turkey finally opening its border with Armenia. And, interestingly, the loser in that deal is Moscow, since it all hinges on the establishment of a trade route through Armenia and Azerbaijan via Turkey to Central Asia and China, circumventing Russia. Interesting times. But, as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, some obstacles still remain.
It was all smiling faces in the White House as US President Donald Trump and his Azerbaijani and Armenian counterparts Ilham Aliyev and Nikol Pashinyan shook hands. The Trump-brokered deal commits Armenia and Azerbaijan to respect each other's territorial integrity, which has been the center of bloody wars over the last few decades. While Azerbaijan still has outstanding demands for changes to the Armenian constitution, Richard Giragossian, director of the Regional Studies Center, a think tank based in the Armenian capital, Yerevan, says the deal is groundbreaking.
This is the latest in a very positive momentum of diplomatic negotiations. And second, there was a very significant agreement on the restoration of trade and transport in terms of road and rail connectivity, representing a one primary incentive for post-war stability. So I think it took both countries closer to peace, but not quite there yet.
Central to the deal was Armenia agreeing to allow the corridor connecting Azerbaijan with its enclave Nakhchivan near the Turkish border. Although the route, known as the Zangezur Corridor, would be on Armenian soil, Azerbaijan has argued that it should be under its control to allow it to guarantee the safety of its citizens. Farid Shafiev of the Center of Analysis of International Relations, a Baku-based think tank.
For us, Zangezur Corridor is important to have direct and easy access to Nakhchivan. We believe that, yes, for 30 years, Armenia occupied our territory. It was pillaged and destroyed. And something we should have in return as an easy access to Nakhchivan. It's not we claiming Armenian sovereignty, but we would like to have unimpeded access to Nakhchivan. So in the current condition, we need security assurances.
Armenia strongly rejected Azerbaijan's calls for control of the corridor. Until recently, the dispute was threatening to ignite a new conflict in the region. But in a surprise move, President Trump resolved the issue by proposing a private American company administer and protect the route, which he modestly dubbed the Trump Route for International Peace and Prosperity. Asla Aydin-Tashbash of the Washington-based Brookings Institute says the new route could have far-reaching consequences.
The area is critical, consequential, because it is going to be a new trade corridor. That means you have unfettered access from Europe through Turkey all the way into Central Asia and eventually China, and potentially an area that bypasses Russia. That has geopolitical significance.
Moscow is not only a loser economically from the Trump-brokered deal. Russia has for decades used the Armenia and Azerbaijan conflict to maintain its influence in the region by playing one side against the other. Armenian Prime Minister Pashinyan is seeking to break away from Russia's hegemony and turn towards Europe. Analyst Giragossian says with Moscow weakened by the Ukraine war, there is a unique opportunity, but warns time is of the essence and Turkey has a key role to play.
There's a closing window of opportunity that Russia's distraction with everything Ukraine. We do expect a storm on the horizon with an angry, vengeful Putin reasserting or attempting to regain Russia's lost power and influence in the region. Armenia, after all, is still a member of the Eurasian Economic Union, the Russian-dominated trade bloc. This is why for Armenia, The real key here is going to be Turkey and normalizing relations with Turkey in order to take this agreement one step further and reopen the border with Turkey.
Flashback to June, Armenia's Prime Minister pays Turkey's president an official visit in Istanbul. It marks a symbolic turning point in Turkish-Armenian relations, long overshadowed by the memory of the Armenian genocide of 1915 and Turkey's decision to close its border with Armenia after ethnic Armenians in Azerbaijan seized the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh enclave in 1993. This month's peace agreement is another major step towards restoring relations. But analyst Aydin Tashbash cautions that Azerbaijan still holds most of the cards.
I think that it will also provide some degree of normalization between Turkey and Armenia. And that, of course, is a historic legacy. It really should, because they had been promising that once there's a peace treaty, they would open the border. But Baku basically able to tell Ankara not to open the border. Turkey has developed an economic dependency on Azerbaijan, which is the top investor in Turkey. In other words, little brother calling the shots.
Currently, the only borders open for the landlocked Armenia are Georgia and Iran, both countries with close ties to Russia. The opening of the Turkish border would be a major boost for Armenia in its efforts to break away from Russia's influence, as well as for the Turkish region bordering Armenia, which too has suffered economically. But for now, Azerbaijan may be well looking for further concessions before green-lighting such a move. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Back in a minute. One of the most significant stories to be impacting Europe at the moment is actually unfolding outside of Europe, in Gaza, to be precise. This Wednesday alone, 25 people were gunned down by Israeli soldiers, according to Gaza's health ministry and witnesses, whilst seeking aid amidst what the Integrated Food Security Phase classification now regards as, quote, the worst case scenario of famine. Four Al Jazeera journalists were killed by an Israeli strike on their tent in Gaza City at the beginning of the week, amongst them 28-year-old correspondent Anas Al-Sharif, who had reported prominently on the war since its outset. Meanwhile, Israel's security cabinet announced plans to take over Gaza City. The ripples of these events have been felt far beyond the Middle East.
I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels. The European Union says Israel is not living up to the pledge it made to the bloc last month to increase the amount of aid allowed to be delivered to Palestinian civilians. That was among the issues foreign ministers discussed at a virtual meeting on Monday, where European Commission spokesperson Anita Hipper says all 27 agreed Israel must fulfill its obligations.
There was absolute consensus on the need of urgency, on the importance of getting the humanitarian aid in the Gaza Strip, but also in terms of the need to ensure that international NGOs that are facing administrative obstacles are let in and fully allowed.
But there's no or else, because the consensus ends there. The European Commission has proposed suspending trade privileges for Israel and cutting it off from the right to receive research funding under one major EU program, but there's not enough support from member governments to make it happen. Now 20 EU countries, along with Foreign Policy Chief Kaya Kallas and several other governments and officials, have signed a joint statement demanding Israel unblock the humanitarian aid and, quote, reverse starvation, saying the suffering in Gaza has reached unimaginable levels. As an unusual sign of just how bitterly fought and deeply felt positions are in Brussels, look no further than some of the street protests outside EU institutions. They're being led by EU staffers themselves, who are risking punishment from their supervisors to speak out about what they see as Israel's inexcusable behavior and the EU's failure to stop it.
I'm Nick Martin. There's growing concern in the UK about the government's use of anti-terrorism laws to crack down on non-violent direct action as a form of protest. Last weekend, over 500 people were arrested in central London during a non-violent demonstration supporting Palestine Action, a pro-Palestinian group that targeted the UK arms industry with direct action, arguing that it is complicit in genocide in Gaza. Organised by Defend Our Juries in Parliament Square, protesters held signs reading, "I oppose genocide, I support Palestine Action." The UK recently banned the group under the Terrorism Act, citing damage to military jets at an Air Force base. The group insists it only conducts peaceful direct action. Many protesters, including the elderly, faced street bail but returned defiantly to the rally after being released by police. Palestine Action called the protest a bold stand. Amnesty International and the UN's Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Terrorism have raised alarms over using counter-terror laws to curb free speech.
It's been 100 days since Friedrich Merz became German Chancellor, and the date this week has been marked by controversy over a sudden policy change towards Israel. And in fact, there's even a new term coined here in political Berlin to describe it, Merzwendung or Merzturn. The shift is the decision by Merz to stop delivering weapons to Israel that might be used in Gaza. And this is in reaction to Benjamin Netanyahu's plan to expand Israel's military offensive and take over Gaza City, a decision which has prompted international condemnation. Merz decided to suspend his summer holiday in Bavaria and has been defending his move, which triggered a backlash from within his own conservative bloc. Many there advocate unconditional support for Israel, based on their interpretation of Germany's historical responsibility after the Holocaust, and they see this move as wrong and a step away from that responsibility. But the reality is also that Merz has been under increasing pressure to make some kind of shift. Close allies like France and the UK announced they could recognize a Palestinian state, something which Merz isn't prepared to do at this stage. Germany is also facing a case at the International Court of Justice brought by Nicaragua, which accuses Berlin of facilitating genocide by supporting Israel, a claim that Germany rejects. Essentially, Merz doesn't want Germany to be seen as internationally isolated and could also be concerned about the possibility of Germany ending up on the wrong side of history once again. This at a time when there's increasing alarm over the humanitarian situation in Gaza, where the IPC, and that's the body advising the UN on food security, says the worst-case scenario of famine is now unfolding. All these matters are also discussed within the German population. Recent polls showed that a majority want the government to up the pressure on the Israeli government to change its approach in the Gaza Strip, and that they also support recognizing a Palestinian state. Whether this recognition will come is still unclear. But if pressure continues to grow for Merz, it could be the next German shift, the next Merzwendung.
Thomas Sparrow ending that selection of European developments in relation to Israel's actions in Gaza, where over 60,000 Palestinians are believed dead. According to the Office of United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, over 70% of those deaths are of women or children. You're listening to Inside Europe. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany.
Hot dust in the sky on a winter's day. Plastic bottles in the sea a thousand miles away. Acid rain from the clouds turn the trees to grey. Playing Russian roulette with our future. Vapor trails smoke the sky like a cigarette. Politicians ride the skies in a private jet. Seems they haven't realized the situation yet. Self-destruction is the etiquette. We're smoking the future like a cigarette. We're smoking the future.
Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm Kate Laycock in Bonn. First off, we need to talk about the weather.
Across the Mediterranean, from Portugal to Italy, Turkey to Montenegro, wildfires are burning.
In several European countries have claimed the lives of at least
thousands of exhausted firefighters are battling to control the blazes.
Around 8,000 people are currently out of their homes. They've been evacuated from their homes.
Europe is the world's fastest warming continent, according to the European Union's Copernicus.
Scientists are describing it as a Molotov cocktail of climate conditions, which is fueling the flames.
Temperature records have been broken all across Europe this week, in countries including France, Croatia and Hungary. Data just published shows that European wildfires have burned more than 400,000 hectares so far this year. That is 87% more than the average for this time of year over the last two decades. At the time of recording, exhausted firefighters are battling flames threatening to engulf the Greek city of Patras, and a Spanish firefighter has been reported dead near the town of Nogareres, north of Madrid. Meanwhile, France remains on high alert after battling its most devastating wildfire in 80 years. Started by the side of a road in a densely wooded part of the Languedoc region in the south of the country, it burnt over 17,000 hectares. That's an area quite a lot bigger than the city of Paris. Our correspondent John Lawrenson reports.
Firefighters talking strategy. Apart from throwing as much water as they can on the fire itself, they've been dousing the nearby vegetation to stop the spread, or sometimes, on the contrary, burning it in controlled fires in order to surround this massive wildfire with a ring of smoking ashes where there's nothing left for the fire to spread to. Over 2,000 firefighters have been battling a forest fire the likes of which none of them have seen before. Because of the speed with which it spread, above all, 6 kilometres an hour at its height, the pace of a fast walk.
Et là, voilà.
Mélanie lifts her hands in the air in despair at the sight of the charred remains of where she used to live. A carer and pig breeder, she lost her house, her 5 vehicles, everything.
Ma vie est partie en fumée.
My life has gone up in flames, she told French TV viewers. All my daughter's things, for example, her clothes, her toys, her personal health record, there's nothing left. It's totally dead, all burnt. Mélanie had been building a shelter for abandoned animals. She saved 30 out of 40 of them. Of the pigs she was raising, she managed to save 2 and a piglet, but another one died in the fire. Houses on the edge of 25 villages burnt to the ground. In one, a woman who refused to leave her house was burnt alive. Firefighter spokesperson Eric Brocardi had this to say about why this fire was so difficult to bring under control. It was very complicated from the outset, he said, because we're trained and equipped to fight fires contained in an envelope of a maximum of 10 hectares. But here, from the get-go, the fire spread incredibly quickly. It was as if a firebomb had hit this corner of France. It was so fast that neither our crews in the air, in our planes and helicopters, nor our crews on the ground could stop it. The strong wind, the low humidity, the very dry vegetation and the hilly terrain made it very difficult to bring the fire under control quickly. And this, he said, in a département that's used to forest fires, where the vegetation is controlled, where fire breaks are in place. Despite all this, it was impossible to fight the fire directly. Our strategy was to protect citizens by withdrawing them or confining them inside their houses, or simply by trying to defend some areas from the fire. As for root causes, the decline of the wine industry is one. Vineyards are good firebreaks. When they're replaced by scrub, this makes it much easier for fire to spread. As for the long-term trend, there was a terrible forest fire in the Landes in southwest France in the 1950s, but the worst year ever was 2022. Outside these peak years, there's been more than a doubling of the number of hectares burnt each year since the middle of the last century. during this 75-year period, average temperatures have risen by 1.5 degrees. Most scientists believe this is caused by human activity, in particular the burning of fossil fuels. As for direct causes, 90% of French forest fires are started, intentionally or not, by people, from campfire sparks to cigarette butts tossed out of car windows to arson. And the police forensic department is currently examining the evidence to try to determine whether this fire was started on purpose.
Donc ça, c'est un prélèvement de terre qui a été fait par les gendarmes ou par la police.
This police scientist told French TV they're examining earth recovered from the place where the fire started. The aim, he said, is to see if it contains traces of hydrocarbons, of vehicle fuel, basically, to determine whether this fire was started voluntarily or not. This summer has suddenly become disastrous for forest fires. This single wildfire consumed more vegetation than all the previous ones this year combined. And as the week came to a close in France, the country was in the grip of another heat wave. John Lawrenson, DW, Paris.
The EU's Copernicus satellite programme has various tools for tracking wildfires. Google Copernicus Forest Fire Emergency to find them. For the global scientific consensus on man-made climate change and its impacts, see the latest IPCC report.
Summer is here and vacation is calling. So at the end of July, we're bringing you a special series with our favorite tips for living a greener life. From what to look out for in your sunscreen to how to reduce your dog's environmental paw print, we'll get insights and advice from the experts and have a look at our own habits. Find our Greener Living series from Living Planet wherever you get podcasts.
Now, for something completely different. A new museum is gradually emerging within the walls of the former factory once run by Oskar Schindler, the German businessman and Nazi Party member who famously rescued hundreds of Jews during World War II. Viewers of Steven Spielberg's acclaimed film will recall that Schindler's famous list contained the names of 1,100 workers whom he transferred from Poland to a factory in Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia, sparing them from Auschwitz. Rob Cameron has been given a tour of that very factory and has sent us this report.
And facing this building is the biggest...
A tour of what 80 years ago was the munitions factory run by Oskar Schindler, now located in the small rundown town of Brunninec in East Bohemia. Back in 1944, this was Brunlitz, newly absorbed into the German Reich.
And they were making munitions, I think.
Making munitions.
My guide is Milan Schudoma from the ARCS Foundation, which is now trying to save these crumbling red brick structures from falling down. Milan explained to me that Schindler's factory was in fact little more than a front for an elaborate operation to prevent 1,100 Jewish forced labourers from being sent to Auschwitz.
The testimonies of the survivors mention that Schindler chose this place on purpose so that he could keep the guards away from the prisoners, so they didn't get in touch every day, and they were kind of guarding the whole area, but they didn't interfere with the Jews on a daily basis, which saved them from you know, violence and so on. Wow.
Schindler was a Sudeten German from the nearby town of Svitavy, so it was very much close to home. By all accounts, he went to great lengths to protect the Jewish workers transferred here from the 80 SS guards living in the adjacent barracks from hunger, cold and disease, and most importantly, from being deported to certain death.
So the prisoners, the Jewish inmates, worked in this building, but where did they live? Where did they sleep?
They slept on the second and the third floor of this building, which we are going to take the steps up now.
Okay.
And they worked on the ground floor. Plus, there is a production hall behind that building. The building itself has an L shape, and it's got three stories. In the middle of that is also a big warehouse or a hall where the production was placed.
Okay, let's go up the stairs.
And yet he's a controversial figure for Czechs, perhaps understandably so. He was an ethnic German industrialist who joined Konrad Henlein's irredentist Sudetendeutsche Partei in 1933. He spied for German military intelligence, the Abwehr, giving them information on Czechoslovak troop movements. And in 1939, just after Hitler seized what was left of Czechoslovakia, ostensibly Schindler's homeland, he joined the Nazi Party.
I don't want to advocate him at all. I just want to say that there were not many members of Nazi Party who would bring 1,200 Jews to a place where they could survive.
For now, the site hosts a brand new visitors' centre located in an adjacent former warehouse. The factory building itself, the former SS barracks, and also a small bungalow which served as Schindler's office now all belong to the foundation, which was set up by Daniel Loew Beer, the British grandson of the original Jewish owners of what was, before the war, their textile factory. Museum guide Andrea Hokova says the foundation has been keen to stress the role of Schindler's wife Emilie, which has often been overlooked.
We also try to highlight the role of Oskar Schindler's wife Emilie, who essentially ran the camp on her own at the time. Her husband was often absent, either in Krakow or even under arrest. And it was really her who took care of saving those Jews. She made sure they were fed, looked after them in the infirmary, provided for their basic needs. And so it was really Emilie Schindler who the inmates can thank for saving them.
Ultimately, only a few journalists are allowed inside the crumbling factory building, which was still operating as a wool processing facility as recently as 2009. For now, visitors can only view the derelict buildings from the outside as they're too dangerous to enter. But if the requisite finances can be found, these buildings too will eventually be opened to the public to show the world what one complex individual did 80 years ago to save so many lives. For DW, this is Rob Cameron in Brněnec.
It's a week for tours. From Rob Cameron touring a historic factory, we move to Ashish Sharma touring a futuristic innovation hub. The said hub belongs to the energy company Mueve, formerly known as Cepsa, Spain's second largest oil company. Mueve stands at the forefront of Spain's energy transition and its commitment to become carbon neutral by 2050. Key to Mueve's strategy is sustainable aviation fuel, which it provides to major airports in the country, and also its plans for energy parks where it can produce green hydrogen. Here's what Ashish Sharma has found out for us.
If you read the company blurb, then it will tell you that Mueve has undergone a seismic shift to transition from an integrated oil and gas company into a leading producer of green molecules, namely sustainable aviation fuels and green hydrogen.
I have a pocket here. Thank you, Tracy.
And to be fair, the company has put its money where its mouth is, a $3 billion investment into energy parks producing SAF on a major scale.
My name is Belén Linares. I am the innovation director in Mueve. So there are two ways of synthesizing SAF, sustainable aviation fuel, for our aviation customers. And in this center, we try to design, test, and catalyze the most forefront technologies in that sense. This is the Energy Transition Lab. In this lab, you have our first pilot plants for electrolysis. Electrolysis is the process that we take the water together with the electricity and we obtain hydrogen and oxygen. Gracias.
Wow, this is much bigger setup here, isn't it?
This is simulating a potential huge investment in the company for ESAF. Currently, the ESAF is being going to be compulsory by 2.7% for the aviation in the following years. So we are starting the company to innovate. We are starting to work with customers on making use of this pioneer ESAF and zero emissions. When you burn the ESAF, There is a CO2, but this is in a global cycle of the process. This is the one that you are capturing in order to create this, giving the RF and BNO, that is green fuel.
The European Union's Green Deal stipulates that from this year, 2% of all aviation fuel must contain SAF. That figure rises to 6% by 2030 and up to 20% within the next decade.
Sorry about that.
Alvaro Macaro is the director of Sustainable Aviation Fuel at Moeve.
Sustainable aviation fuel, it's real jet fuel alternatives produced with forest and agricultural residues, also use cooking oil. It has the capacity to reduce greenhouse emissions over 80% compared to jet fuel conventional. You don't have to do any modifications in the engines or in the airport infrastructure. It's what we call a drop-in solution.
And how much of it can you produce?
We started producing SAF in Moeve back in 2022, 3 years ahead of the European mandate. We're also increasing our production capacity with the construction of a standalone plant, of a new facility, and it's going to have a total production capacity of 500,000 tons. This is 3 times the total volume needed for the mandate in Spain by 2030. And normally passengers or public in general, they don't know that every time we take a flight now, since January 1st, 2025, we are flying with SAF.
You're about to invest or are investing 1.3 billion euros in developing your research or your centre in Huelva. So where is that finance coming for you to be able to do that?
Yeah, that's very important and a very good question, because to meet the next steps and to be able to reach the new percentages, we're going to have to do more investments. We're looking for partners. We're looking for also support from the administrations, public policies, incentives for the demand, incentives for supply.
While Moeve maintains its research in SAF and eSAF, there is some caution over plans like this. Almuth Ernsting is the co-director of Biofuels Watch, a campaign group which looks at large-scale industrial bioenergy production.
There's no possibility that you could replace even a significant share of fossil fuels as biofuels without basically chopping down any remaining rainforest. So the availability of these residues is actually much smaller than the demand for it. Increasing this market will mean more deforestation, more rainforest destruction, more peatland destruction, more land grabbing away from indigenous peoples and forest, other forest-dependent communities and small farmers as well, not being any way beneficial compared to the fossil fuels that they replace. So that is our big concern. There was a study published, in fact, commissioned by the European Commission some years ago, which shows that especially virgin palm oil biofuels are 3 times as bad for the climate as the fossil fuels they replace. And we are very concerned that the EU is going down this road.
The rush to produce green fuel is being driven by political mandates that are creating a race for the greenest solution. But this isn't based on reality, according to campaigners. For Moeve, the research being done in their innovation centre is to bridge the argument and try to find industrial-scale answers that can meet the demands of SAF, eventually becoming the main source of fuel. Ashish Sharma, DW, Madrid.
Oh, guilt-free air travel, wouldn't that be a great thing? In the meantime, there is always the train. I'm Kate Claycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. We end the show with a real treat, a celebration of Italy's best-loved comic character, Pimpa, who turned 50 this year. A white dog with red spots, long floppy ears, and a penchant for adventure, Pimpa's been Italy's answer to Paddington Bear for more than 20 generations, the star of her own eponymous comic, animated cartoon, and now her very own travelling birthday exhibition called Buon Compleanno Pimpa, or Happy Birthday Pimpa. Currently in Aquileia, the exhibition was launched at the Children's Book Fair in Bologna, an event which our reporter Danny Mitzman and her daughter Arianna were not about to miss.
Perché la pimpa, ecco perché. Perché la pimpa,
that is my daughter and her friends singing the Pimpa theme tune, because everybody grows up with Pimpa.
Oh, yeah, everybody. You can't not grow up with Pimpa. I mean, that's just unfair and sad.
Who is Pimpa to you then?
Oh, Pimpa was like my best friend.
Pimpa is a joyful, friendly talking dog, white with big red spots and very long ears. She lives with Armando, a kind man with a big hat and a bigger moustache.
Il prato è ingiallito.
Perché non ha piovuto. Ora faccio un
po'. In Pimpa's world, everyone and everything can talk. Other animals, trees and flowers, food and milk, the sun and the clouds, even the Hoover and the armchair.
Tu vai in bagno e di' alla lavatrice di venire qui.
Eccomi!
Almost unknown outside Italy, Pimpa truly is a national icon. Her creator is Francesco Tullio Altan, a well-known satirical cartoonist who's now in his 80s, known professionally simply as Altan. He tells me how Pimpa was born way back in 1975 by pure chance.
I did drawings for my daughter, who was about 2 at the time. She would ask me to draw her various things, and one of them was the character of this little dog. We borrowed a family friend's nickname, and that's how she got her name.
At their stand at Bologna Children's Book Fair, Altan's surrounded by Pimpa comic collections, merchandise, and 2 new books to celebrate her 50th birthday. He's also surrounded by a swarm of adult fans who grew up reading Pimpa. Her decades of success are something he says he never imagined.
No, because I didn't invent her for a publication. It really was a private game between me and my daughter. Then, through a series of circumstances, a great friend, who was my agent at the time, took it to the Corriere dei Piccoli, which was an historic children's comic that no longer exists. They published her, and that's where the story began.
By 1987, Pimpa had her own monthly magazine and television cartoon series. When I ask Altan about Pimpa's enduring popularity, he answers with endearing humility.
Frankly, I don't know. I think maybe, since the character was born without being commissioned by a publisher, it's maintained a spontaneity or simplicity of approach that really works for children. Pimpa's readers are very young, and over the last 50 years, little children haven't changed so much.
Nor has Pimpa's world, which is refreshingly tech-free. There's a computer and a television, but no mobiles, only an old-fashioned phone with a dial, plus 7 pages of simple classic kids' activities and games like Spot the Difference, all created by Altan himself. A perfect mix my daughter Arianna adored.
Bam, brum, taka-boom, brum.
We had an annual subscription, and I remember Arianna's excitement every time a new issue arrived.
They had 2 little stories in them, and a bedtime story for your parents to read to you. And at the end there was a game and a page full of kids' drawings.
I think you learnt to read with Pimpa.
Yeah, I did, because at one point Dad gave up on reading them to me. So I had to learn to read them. Every so often I still read them.
Arianna's friends also have fond Pimpa memories, especially twins Melissa and Rebecca. Melissa remembers the excitement of seeing her drawing published in the gallery section. She tells me her grandma always bought it for her, and she really loved reading all the stories. Rebecca recalls feeling happy whenever she read the comic. She says Pimpa taught her kindness through the way she always helped her animal friends. As well as the stories, she liked the stickers, even if she admits she stuck them on really badly. And she loved the tear-out constructions, especially the flower, which her grandma still has.
E la pimpa correva, In campagna o in città.
In the cartoon, they also used to love it when she would like go really fast. She would run or go somewhere really fast, and then her spots would fly off and go behind, like trail behind her. And then they'd, when she stopped, they'd go back on her. It was really fun. And yeah, I think Pimpa's really special because I grew up with Pimpa.
Altan reckons he's written about 1,200 stories about Pimpa and her friends, often inspired by those around him. A new character, a little yellow duck called Olivia, arrived 18 years ago with the birth of his granddaughter. Although he's never run out of story ideas, I wonder if he ever thinks about retiring.
Sometimes I think I could stop, but knowing there are still quite a few children who wait for her and who don't consider her as a character to read about, but as a friend and a playmate, I think it would be a horrible thing to tell them she's gone. So I keep going as long as I can. I'll keep going.
Armando è uscito. Ha detto che quando torna.
The stories usually follow a formula where Pimpa goes off for an adventure, then comes home to tell Armando all about it. When I asked Arianna's friends who their favourite character was, without hesitation, there was a unanimous
Armandone!
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 Ma perché Armandone?
Because Armandone gives a certain sense of security. He's there. He observes everything. He doesn't interfere much. He lets her do things, pretends to believe all the stories she tells him. I think he's a good father figure.
Altan says Pimpa's not designed to be educational and his role isn't to teach. That said, does he want his young readers to learn something?
To learn to look at things in a certain way, perhaps, yes. But definitely not rules. Curiosity, for sure. To stimulate them, show them the possibility of an adventure, whether it's real or not, that's important.
Pimpa's tireless curiosity is matched by her respectful treatment of everyone and everything, and her spontaneous kindness and generosity. It's a world away from the satirical political cartoons Altan draws for newspapers.
I don't know if it's my favorite world, but it's very useful for my mental balance. Sometimes, when reality becomes too disgusting, I take refuge there, and I feel better because Pimpa's world is the world I wish existed.
A world which adults who grew up reading Pimpa also continue to love.
What makes me happy is that they also have children and things continue that way. Parents who read Pimpa when they were young can read it to their children in a different way from those who are discovering it for the first time. There's a little tradition that continues within the family. I think that's lovely.
Danny Mitzman, DW, Bologna.
Happy 50th birthday, Pimpa. And happy birthday, Arianna. 12 years old this week and very much the star of that report. Who are your favourite European children's characters? Finnish Moomins? Britain's Paddington Bear? Sweden's Pippi Longstocking? Belgium's Tintin? France's Asterix and Obelix? You can vote for them all over on Spotify, or perhaps your favourite is one that we've not even thought about yet, in which case do drop us a line at insideeurope@dw.com or send us a voice memo via speakpipe.com/insideeurope. Inside Europe is, of course, also available on all the other usual platforms as well, and that includes YouTube via the DW Podcasts channel. That's it for today. This programme was produced by Laura Kabelka and me, Kate Laycock. Special thanks to Lavinia Pitu for extra editorial support. Our sound engineer was Jürgen Kuhn. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.